During this episode, you will hear our hosts intend to add video of Tom Hammond's work in post-production. Unfortunately, after recording, we learned that due to certain restrictions, we will not be able to add them to the episode. We do encourage that if you are interested to hear or see his work, to look it up and watch it on your own. We hope you enjoy this week's episode of Hot Mic.
LEX 18 presents a podcast with hot takes, hot topics, with your hosts, Megan Mannering and Evelyn Schultz. This is Hot Mic.
Welcome into this week's episode of Hot Mic.
Our guest, he was on the list from the get-go of someone that we wanted on. Might have been number one. He's a Lexington legend. We have a lot to cover. Mm-hmm. I know he has a lot of stories. Everybody, welcome to the podcast, Tom Hammond. Oh, welcome in.
Legend means you're real old.
No.
You've earned that title, though. You put in the hard work to get there. Well,
right. Okay, let's just run through this real quick. For our listeners who may not know you, you've covered college and pro sports, NBA, NFL. You have horse racing expertise. That's kind of what you're known for. You've done SEC play-by-play. You're an author of your book, Races, Games, Olympic Dreams, A Sportscaster's Life. And the Olympics, which is timely right now. You've covered many Olympics.
13 Olympics, summer and winter.
Yes, you have a few stories maybe there in the archives.
The Olympics are the best, too. They're the top of the heap.
Yeah.
All the other things are great, don't get me wrong, and I've loved doing all of them, but the Olympics, it's, you know, for all its faults, and there have been lots of cheating scandals and doping and everything else, there's always a problem. Right now, the Russian athletes are, you know, barred, and so that it has its problems, as does the entire world, but it's the only thing in the world that I know of where everyone comes together peacefully and competes in a peaceful way. You know, and just to be there with everyone from the world and all the different cultures coming together and learning about each other. And it's just a tremendous event to be at and to be part of.
Growing up in Kentucky as a kid, did you ever think one day I'll have a front row seat to 13 Olympic Games?
Had no idea. I had no idea whatsoever that I'd ever be a broadcaster and to be a part of the Olympics. And I watched the Olympics, of course, growing up, as everyone did. But to imagine to be a part of it, to be calling Usain Bolt setting a world record in the 100 meters, or Sarah Hughes surprisingly winning a gold medal in figure skating and stuff. So I did, I think, 5 winter games, and the rest were summer, 8 summer games. We didn't get the winter game rights until 2002. And I did mostly figure skating in the winter and mostly track and field in the summer. Although I also did men's and women's basketball and gymnastics and skating, speed skating and diving also.
So many interesting.
I have like a ton of questions. Also, right before you got here, we were watching you call Usain Bolt's record. Oh my gosh. Goosebumps.
Yeah.
It's so exciting.
Oh, well.
I feel like you could watch that 100 times and it just doesn't get old.
The 100 meters at the Summer Olympics is the centerpiece of the Olympics as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Some may disagree. It's the hardest thing that I did. Of all those sports I've named, the most difficult of all was to call the 100-meter dash.
Why is that so hard?
It's over in 9 seconds. So if
makes
you
sense.
You either get it right or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately for the man that was calling it in the Paris Olympics, they got it wrong. Knock on wood.
Yeah.
I never got one wrong.
But, when it's so close, how can you tell?
Are you looking at it? Are you focusing in person? Or are you watching it on a screen?
Well, you know, everybody has their different methods. I started out with binoculars, watching for about the first 50 meters.
Okay,
and then took them down and watched live from there. Okay. I didn't watch the monitor. I just watched the live on the track. And while I say it's the most difficult, I will have to say that, when Usain Bolt is in the field, it's a little easier.
Such a lead, right? Yeah. What is it like witnessing these incredible world-class athletes? I mean, they're one of one, right? It's just incredible. What is it like to see them in person?
I mean, it's a thrill. Even if you're a professional and even if you're doing your job, it's still a thrill to see that and to be there when it happens. When Usain Bolt in Beijing set the world record, smashed the world record, and while clowning around just before the finish. No telling how fast he could have gone. I mean, it was like, whew, I was part of that.
Yeah.
I mean, that was
almost
something.
Superhuman.
And so everything leads to a story of me, so I apologize.
No, that's why you're here.
So,
Tom, that's why we have a podcast. Go nuts.
So the 96 Olympics in Atlanta, Michael Johnson of the U.S. was trying to become the first man to ever win the 400 meters and the 200 meters in the same Olympics. Mm-hmm. Won the 400, set a world record. So he lines up in the for the 200 meters. Now, this is before everybody had cell phones with cameras on them. So as he ran the curve, and the 200 meters is on the curve, and as they ran the curve, the flash bulbs just followed him around. He had on golden shoes, which flashed in the lights as he came. And as I was calling the race, I started out sitting like this, and by the end of the race, I was standing up without even knowing I had done it. And he crossed the finish line into Olympic history, and as I said on the air, and set another world record when he did it. Well, I was feeling pretty good about myself. I went back to the hotel, and there was always after the day's events, NBC takes over a whole hotel for news, Today Show, and sports. And so everybody congregates in the bar to rehash the day's events. And I was in the bar, and everybody was patting me on the back and congratulating me, so I was feeling pretty good about myself. And the next day, we went to do the next day's Olympics, and I'm there 2 hours before the events begin and getting ready and stuff, and I look up into the stands, and someone's going. So I look up, and I look again.
Mm-hmm.
My goodness, it's Jimmy Carter.
So what?
I said, yeah, so I said to myself, well, this is pretty cool deal. Jimmy Carter, the former president, is inviting me up to compliment me on my call of Michael Johnson last night.
Wow.
So I go up there and I said, yes, sir, Mr. President. He said, you work for NBC. Can you move that camera? It's blocking my view.
Stop.
Wow.
What
so,
a story.
So much for feeling good.
Well,
about
yeah. But hey, not many people can say that, no. You know, they've been in the presence of a president. I've heard you say that you loved covering figure skating, which I think is surprising as a guy who's, you know, covered these really macho sports, football and basketball. What is it about figure skating that you love?
It's kind of the way I felt when they said you can cover figure skating. But then Dick Ebersol, who was chairman of NBC Sports, said, you know, it's the most watched Olympic sport, summer or winter.
Uh-huh. Really?
So an honor to do the figure skating.
Was that kind of the challenge for you?
And I've already done figure skating, you know, non-Olympic figure skating for the last few years. So it wasn't like I was totally a cold turkey. I was cold turkey when they first said, want you to do figure skating. I did an NBA game in Atlanta and then flew to Munich for the World Championships. And the next day, everybody else was already there. The next day, I went to a meeting. And with all the announcers and the production people. And when it was over, I waited till everybody left. And I said to David Michaels, Al Michaels' younger brother, who was the producer, I hope you know that I didn't understand a single thing you guys were talking about. Oh, you'll be okay. You'll be fine. So I went to Sandra Besick from Canada, former skater, Canadian skater and choreographer, said, come on, and took me to practice. And Kurt Browning was then the reigning world champion. And we sat on the front row to watch practice, and right in front of us, he went up and went, shh, boom, made a jump. And I said, whoop. I said, hold it. Maybe this isn't all fluff and feathers after all.
Yeah.
There might be some athletic ability involved here. And sure enough, it was. And so I learned about it. I asked a lot of dumb questions. I never became an expert and didn't want to be, actually. I wanted to sort of bring the everyman approach. But Christy Yamaguchi answered so many stupid questions of mine. It was, you know, it was great. And I came to think, and I tell all my chauvinist male friends who think, you know, figure skating. I believe the ladies' final skate, the ladies' long skate at the Olympics is the most pressure-packed event in all of sports. You've worked your whole life to be there. You probably only get one chance at it. Sometimes you make two Olympics, but mostly you get one shot at it. You're out there on the ice by yourself for 4 minutes, knowing that if you make the slightest mistake, just the slightest mistake, your whole life's work is done.
My and heart is beating.
I know. My hands are sweating.
Yeah. And that's pressure. I mean, that is pressure. And you can see some of the best skaters succumb to that pressure. And again, everything leads to a story. So Salt Lake City Olympics 2002, Arina Sliskaya of Russia and Michelle Kwan of the U.S. were the favorites. Michelle Kwan, the most decorated figure skater in American history, but never won an Olympic gold medal. So they skate the short program, and after that, as expected, Sliskaya and Kwan are 1-2, and the U.S. also has another skater there that's Sarah Hughes. She's a 16-year-old that nobody gives a chance to medal at all. She stands in, I can't remember, fourth place, I think, after the short program. And the way the scoring was then, virtually no chance to win. Everything would just have to be perfect. So they come to the final long skate. Sarah Hughes skates first amongst this group and has the skate of her life. As I said on the air, Sarah Hughes just brought the house down. The look on her face when she finished was like, what just happened?
She couldn't believe she wasn't expecting that.
Yeah.
My goodness. So everything that was perfect. So anyway, then the two favorites skate, and sure enough, they succumb to that pressure. They don't skate their best. Mm-hmm. And then we're awaiting the scores, and our producer and director had a shot of Sarah Hughes backstage as she watched the scores. And sure enough, she won the gold medal, and the look on her face was just priceless. Was she and her coach standing there, and she won the gold medal. So that's how the pressure can affect skaters. And you see it in the current Olympics that we're experiencing now. And one more little PS to that. Michelle Kwan, who was a wonderful person, then became an ambassador, a United States ambassador to the United Nations. And she, the skaters skate an exhibition on the Sunday after the competition. No judges. Mm-hmm. The skaters get to pick their own program. They pick the music. They pick everything about it. It's just for exhibition, for fun. And it's one of the hottest tickets, actually, always. The fans love to come see them skate to what they want to skate to. And she had chosen as her music Fields of Gold by Sting. And here she was expected to win gold. She was looking for the only thing, hole in her resume was no Olympic gold. And she skates to Fields of Gold.
Wow.
And she skates, the tears just cascade down her face onto the ice. It was such a poignant moment. Yeah. So anyway.
The storylines that you see with the Olympics. Yeah. I love all the storytelling. And I am like a diehard figure skating fan. I know nothing about it. Larry Smith probably wants to tell me to shut up because I've been going on and on about it all week. Have you been watching Chalk and Bates?
Yeah.
Wow. So good. And then this new kid, the kid
French
from Virginia, and the French couple.
Oh, yeah, you mean the quad god.
The quad god.
Yeah.
Does a backflip on the ice. Yeah. I mean.
That used to be illegal.
Yes.
You couldn't
do a backflip. In the times I was calling figure skating, a backflip was prohibitive. Scott Hamilton always did one in his exhibition shows, but you couldn't do a backflip. It was prohibited. So
is there an athlete today that you wish you could cover?
Ooh.
You know, I was with so many and so many different times and so many different sports. I was in an age of specialization. I was lucky to cover all those different sports. And so I'd have to really think about that. But over the years, interviewing somebody like Jesse Owens, you know, or things like that, I was just so lucky. One of the real fun things that happened was I was doing a Chicago Bulls game when Michael Jordan had quit to play baseball and then had come back. And he wasn't pleased with his shooting. So like 3 hours before the game, and I'm there getting ready for the game, and he shows up to take extra shooting practice. But there's nobody there with him. And so for the next half hour or so, he shoots, and I rebound for him.
I catch the ball and
throw it back. And so he's ragging about Kentucky, and I'm getting on North Carolina. And, we're going back and forth. And so just little things like that. Parts of the job when you visit with the jockeys that have just had great rides and I go on and on, but I'd have to really think if there's somebody that I would really like to
get back to us on that.
Your bucket list is basically checked off at this point.
Right.
You've done almost everything.
Definitely. Starting from the very beginning though, Tom, how does a kid from Kentucky end up rebounding for Michael Jordan and meeting Jimmy Carter? How does that happen?
Yeah, that's a good question because we still haven't figured that out. Lucky being in the right place at the right time. I never dreamt I would be an announcer of any kind. I'll be on TV. I was sort of shy in high school and As a 15-year-old, a visit to Keeneland convinced me I wanted to go into the horse business. And so in the summers of my high school years, I worked at Spendthrift Farm. And then in the summers of my college years, I went to New York and worked at Belmont Park and Saratoga as a groom.
And you were an equine science major.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't take journalism. I didn't take, you know, communications. I didn't never took a single course in those, actually. And I was thought I was going to go into the horse business. And when I graduated, I couldn't find a very good job. So out of semi-desperation, I went to graduate school. And while I was in graduate school, to pick up some extra money, I started working for a local horseman, Tom Gentry, who was this flamboyant horse breeder and selling his horses for millions of dollars at the sales. And started working for him looking up pedigrees. And at one point he had a party, and he invited me to his party. And one of his friends was Dave Hooper, who worked for the Daily Racing Form. But he also had a show on WVLK radio in the evenings where he read the race results. In those days, you couldn't get everything with a click like you can today. So if you bred a horse running in New York, you had to wait till the next day to find out how he did, unless you listened to this horse racing results show. So he was being transferred to Miami by his primary employer, the Racing Form. Couldn't find anyone to take his place. And I might have had a cocktail or two. And I said,
a little liquid courage.
I bet I can do that. So he said, it's fine. We'll see you down at VLK tomorrow at 5 o'clock. And I started, I was terrible. I started reading the race results for $35 a week.
Were you nervous to embark on that?
I was, yes.
Even though you'd put yourself out there for it.
Yeah, but I needed the $35.
Sure.
So, And so then having that foot in the door, I, started doing a nightly sports show. It was you guys wouldn't know this, but there was a local beer actually brewed in Newport named Wiedemann, and they had a show, the Wiedemann Sports Eye, every night on WVLK. The great Claude Sullivan had done it before I did. So I started doing that. I knew I'd arrived when a Wiedemann truck pulled up in front of my house and delivered a case of Wiedemann beer.
Let's go.
But anyway, that foot in the door, so I started doing that nightly sports show. Then I started doing news as a reporter. And then I became news director. Then I became program director. Then I got into an argument with Ray Holbrook, the general manager, and he fired me. And so I was without a job for a while until I came to LEX 18 and as the sports director of a one-man sports department. And was here for 10 years.
From 70 to 80, is that right?
Basically.
You are an LEX 18 legend, right? I know we use the word legend, but...
Seriously, but different building, though, at that time.
Down over the hill from where we are now.
Okay.
We're building, the old building with the tower right there. Part of the building.
Who were some of the other LEX 18 icons you worked with at the time?
Sue Wiley. When I began, I learned so much from her. I knew nothing about television. I mean, I've been in the radio for a year and a half or whatever, but about writing and about covering things and interviewing and stuff. I learned a lot from observing her and others and a lot of crazy things. It was so primitive compared to now, and a lot of crazy things happened. Sometimes we'll tell all those stories too. but it was a great experience. I look back on it fondly, and I learned so much. And Harry Barfield, whom we mentioned, the late Harry Barfield, the general manager, gave me the freedom to learn. He wasn't always looking over my shoulder, do this, do that. I don't think he ever told me. He let me find my way, and also let me work at Keeneland to supplement my income, so I didn't have to look for a job in a bigger market all the time. So. It like I say, everything worked out just great. How'd you become a sportscaster? Well, you'd never guess, and it all just worked out perfectly.
We have so many questions for this. Were there people along the way that encouraged you, mentors that said, you know, like, you've got something special?
John Duvall, who was a later station manager here at LEX 18, was a neighbor of mine and also was working at WVLK when I first started. And he sort of took me under his wing and let me know some basics about broadcasting. Again, I knew nothing. I never had any idea that I would ever be a broadcaster. So he was one of my early mentors. And J.B. Faulkner, who was the publicity director at Keeneland, took me under his wing also and helped me learn about horses and how they cover them in the media. And then the greatest mentor slash friend in my career, in my life, was Dick Enberg, who you talk about a legend. Now, there's a sportscaster. Mm-hmm. He was during his time the top sportscaster in America in all sorts of disciplines, different sports. And again, everything leads to a story, so brace yourself. Here we go again. When I was here at Channel 18, we called it Channel 18 then, LAX 18, when NBC would come to town, usually to broadcast a basketball game at the Florida Coliseum, in fact, those big remote trucks would park out in the concourse in front, and I would go by there and say, I wonder if any day I would be able to do something like that. So anyway, I would go down and volunteer my services to them and say, you know, stuff about the players or the team that might help them in their broadcasts. So I got to know the announcers, Dick Enberg, Billy Packer, and Al McGuire, the greatest threesome ever in sports broadcasting history. And the producers and the directors, I got to know them all and would tell them what I knew if it might or might not help them. And on one of these occasions, Dick Enberg said to me, you know, my plane doesn't leave until several hours after the game is going to be over. Is there any way that you can take me to see Secretariat? So I made arrangements, and after the game, Dick got in my car, and we went to Paris, Kentucky, to Claiborne Farm. Okay. We were joined by Seth Hancock, who was the Hancock family owns Claiborne Farm, and he ran the farm. And we went out to Secretariat's paddock, and he always knew he was the star of the show. So when he saw somebody there at the fence, he came over to the fence. And so as we're standing there looking at him, Dick says to me, he said, well, how can you know a horse is going to be great? I said, well, it's really an inexact science. You really don't know. You look at their pedigree to see what their ancestors have done, and you look at how they're put together to see if they could be athletic. And but after that, it's kind of a crapshoot. You don't really have any idea if they're going to succeed or not. And Seth Hancock says, sometimes you can see it in their eyes. And when he said that, Secretariat went and looked Dick Enberg right in the eye. And he never forgot that. And that was the beginning of a great friendship that we had together. And not only was he my mentor, but he was my friend. And we had lots of great. I made a deal with him one time where I would take him to Royal Ascot if he would take me to Wimbledon. So I had a great experience. We were in our top hat and tails in the Royal Enclosure at Ascot.
I can see you rocking that look. For sure.
Not good. In fact, I've got a good picture of us in our top hat and tails with our wives there, and I'm holding my top hat like this, and he's putting money into it like that. This is how much this costs us. And then he took me to Wimbledon to the broadcast spot, which was like a bunker right down on the court level. And so anyway, and we did lots of things like that together. And
that is just incredible. The opportunities you've gotten.
Yeah. And he also was one of the ones that recommended me to be on the NBC's coverage of the first Breeders' Cup in 1984, which is what got me to NBC for 34 years.
And that's something that is remarkable to me about your story, because not many people can say they went from Lexington, Kentucky to broadcast sports, right? That jump is pretty impressive.
Pretty rare. Yeah.
So well, how did that happen for you?
In those days, it was, you know, chances were nil, because there were only three networks, NBC, ABC, and CBS. There was no Fox, there was no ESPN, there was no cable. And so to be on the network doing covering sports was pretty, it'd be a long shot for someone that had never worked in a market bigger than Lexington. But when they got the first Breeders' Cup, NBC is doing these horse racing telecasts, and they didn't have any idea how to do it. They'd never done racing. So they had amassed a whole bunch of announcers. But Dick was one of the ones that said to them, you know, take a look at me. So they hired me to be on the broadcast, the first Breeders' Cup. That's 1984. And my deal was to roam the backstretch. And one of the, you know, things just broke right again for me, just as they had all those other times that we mentioned in my career. And one of the things that I did, I went to John Henry, was a horse that was in the running to be Horse of the Year, but he was injured and couldn't run in the first Breeders' Cup. So depending on the outcome of the first Breeders' Cup Classic, the $3 million Classic, depending on the outcome, he could or could not be Horse of the Year. So I thought it'd be fun. I put a TV monitor up in front of his stall. And so I said, you know, So I'm standing by a stall ready to go on the air. And it, just at that moment, someone, I don't know who it was, and I still don't know to this day who it was, sent John Henry a dozen red roses. So I said, here, hand me those roses. So I was holding the roses and telling the story about he was going to watch the race. And as I'm talking, he leans out of his stall and begins to munch those roses. And it was such a cute picture that they replayed it several times.
Yeah.
Going to break in the mm-hmm. broadcast. And then I was supposed to be done by the time the classic was mm-hmm. run. And as mm-hmm. I went back in front of the, I'd been on the backstretch, went mm-hmm. back in front to watch the race, standing by the finish line. And as they came down the stretch, all hell broke loose. And wild again, gate dancer and slew of gold, mm-hmm. and bumping, mm-hmm. all this stuff. And, sorry. And, so the wild again was one of the long shots in the race.
Mm-hmm.
And to backtrack a bit, I had interviewed his owner, Bill Allen, before the race. And as I said, why in the world they had to put up a supplemental entry, because he hadn't been one of the original entries. They paid 300 and some thousand to make this horse wow. run, and he was 35 to 1. They had yeah. no chance to win.
Yeah.
And I said to Bill Allen, why would you put up that kind of money to have a horse run that has no chance? And he said, well, not only do we, did we put up that money because we think he deserves it, we think he's going to win. And between us, Wild Again, who was a gray horse, had his head out of the stall as we were talking on either side of him. And he said, we think he's going to win. And the horse goes.
Horses know, don't they?
They do. They do.
So anyway, he crossed the finish line first, and then the inquiry sign goes up. The jockeys dismount, and they go over to the phone, talk to the stewards to give their version mm-hmm. of events. What happens? Is there going to be mm-hmm. a disqualification? Or will Wild Again, who crossed the finish line first, be the upset winner? And the rider of Wild Again was Pat Day, who is the greatest jockey in Kentucky history. He was based in Kentucky. And, of course, I knew him from days in Kentucky. So I'm yeah. not even supposed to be working. I'm just standing there looking stupid. And after he talks to the stewards, he sees me over there, and he just walks over there to be interviewed. So I say to the producer, I've got Pat Day here. So here I am interviewing Pat Day to get the first interview about the big disqualification possibly mm-hmm. and everything else. Wild Again won. He was mm-hmm. the official winner. And when the day was over, we were off the air. I walked out on the track, and John Gaines, who had thought up the whole concept of mm-hmm. the Breeders' Cup, gave me this huge bear hug because he knew he had a winner. And Michael Weissman, who was the executive producer of NBC Sports, said, well, until this week, we didn't realize we had a broadcaster on our hands. Would you be interested in doing other things for NBC Sports, starting with NFL football? And that was the start of 34 years.
Amazing. I love about your story mm-hmm. that it's a testament to, when you get that call, when yep. you get that chance, you just have to, seize mm-hmm. the moment, right?
Yeah, Mary Lynn Capiluto read my book, and she came back and she said, you were relentless.
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought of that. I never mm-hmm. really thought, but she yeah. said the same thing you said, Megan, that, when you saw an opportunity or a chance, mm-hmm. you went for it. Mm-hmm. And that's something I tell youngsters now that are, because I said, mm-hmm. You have to be committed and you have to be passionate about this because mm-hmm. there's a lot of setbacks and it can be very frustrating.
Yeah.
So you have to really be passionate about it. But if you get a chance just to get a foot in the door to do whatever job, mm-hmm. do it, because you never know what it'll lead to.
I think at the time you started working for NBC Sports, you were 40 years
yeah,
old. Is 40 that
years
accurate?
Old. 40 years old.
Would you have stayed at LEX 18 forever if you hadn't gone to network? Where do you think your career would have ended up?
You know, I enjoyed it. I liked it, but I did feel I had to do something different. And
mm-hmm.
I mentioned that I'd been the announcer at the Keeneland sales. Mm-hmm. I sit yeah. with the auctioneers and tell about the horse's pedigree, then the auctioneer's selling. Well, I not only was doing that at Keeneland then, so people around the country began to hire me to do that. So I went to Florida, to California, mm-hmm. to Maryland, all over. And so that was getting more lucrative than to stay at Channel 18. So after 10 years, 1980, I decided mm-hmm. I would leave because I didn't have enough time to do both. I had to go around the country mm-hmm. to do these horse sales. But I said to myself, there's going to be some time in between. What are you going to do with that? I said, well, what do you know about? Well, I guess television and horse racing. So with Ron Masotti as my partner, we started a video production company that specialized in equine things. In fact, we pioneered some different techniques. One was to go out into the fields and to videotape the yearlings as they ran through the field, because if you go to the yearling sale, you never see them in motion. You just see them walking from here
right,
to there.
Right.
So it was a, wow. An and then we would send those all over the world to prospective buyers. We also had a weekly racing results show that where we showed the big races from around the country during the past week here on LEX 18. And anyway, that was what I did in between.
Okay.
And then one more thing. And then in 1980, I was hired to do the, and I really went after this one too, hired to do the play-by-play on the SEC basketball. They were starting a primetime game of the week. And so everybody I knew, I had to write a letter. Joe B. Hall, Adolph Rupp, Dan Issel. And it was at a network called TVS in New York, and they were going to do this primetime game. And so I finally got my congressman, the 6th district congressman there was Larry Hopkins. And so he wrote a letter to me, and I got a call from the people in New York. Said, Tom. Stop with the letters. We've never gotten a letter from a congressman before. Go ahead. You've got the job. So
wow. You had to call in everyone.
Yeah. Relentless is the word.
And I did that for 30 years.
And
most of that time with one of my best friends, Larry Connolly, that I've known since we were 16 years old. Aww. Who was one of Rupp's runts, one of the famous Kentucky basketball players.
Wow.
What's the best SEC atmosphere for basketball?
Best atmosphere, that's a good question. The rowdy reptiles of Florida are pretty good.
Ooh.
And Kentucky, of course, is sort of the gold standard. But the Kentucky fans can be a little fickle. Sometimes they're not so loud, especially if they assume they're going to win the game. They don't really get into it. But in a big game, Rupp Arena being so big, it's a great atmosphere. In those days, the SEC basketball was sort of a stepchild. It was just gaining acceptance as most of the football was the king. And there was more interest in spring football than there was in basketball at a lot of places.
God, that just seems like crazy now.
Places like Auburn and Alabama and LSU. LSU, they played in the livestock judging pavilion with a floor put down over the dirt. Until they built until Pete Maravich came along and built the Pete Maravich Center. But all those atmospheres. Tennessee was always good. Mm-hmm. Tennessee, the atmosphere was always pretty good. And when Arkansas joined the league, that was one of the best of all. They're always rabid fans and always a great setting. But now they're all pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You've had so many triumphs in your career, but with a career as long as yours, there had to have been some moments that didn't quite go as planned. I mean, it's broadcast, live sports. Were there any moments that just did not go like you wanted them to?
You know, most of the mistakes and stuff I made weren't funny. They were just, oh, my God. I can remember doing the SEC basketball. Auburn's football coach was named Pat Dye, D-Y-E. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And during one of the basketball telecasts, we had to do pregame, halftime, postgame. We had to do everything. And so during the halftime, I was to interview Pat Dye, and I did interview him. And as I signed off, I said, thanks. That's Pat Day, the football coach here at Auburn. Not realizing I'd said it. Uh-huh. I said it, but I didn't realize.
Yeah, totally.
For some reason, the look on this on the coach's face as he got up to leave, it was like, I was saying, what happened? I had no idea.
Did I offend him somehow?
And then later we looked back at the at the tape, and I called Pat Dye Pat Day. So he didn't like that. But a lot of things were mistakes that weren't too funny. And as I said, luckily I never called the wrong winner of of one of those races or anything else. But the mistakes I made were just one of the worst mistakes. One of the worst mistakes was my first track and field broadcast. Again, I'd done an NBA game. This was in Boston, the Pacers and the Celtics. I remember it. Got home on Sunday night, and on Monday my phone rings, and it's Dick Ebersole. the chairman of NBC Sports, and I'm saying, oh, no. Oh, no. What did I do on the game that was bad that Ebersol is calling me? And he said, oh, good job on the game yesterday. What do you know about track and field? I said, well, not much. I've been to a couple of track meets, but really don't know anything about it. He said, well, you'll be fine. I want you to do the U.S. Championships in 2 weeks.
Wow.
And then, assuming that goes well, the World Championships in Tokyo, and then next year and the Olympics at Barcelona to do track and field there.
Okay, talk about pressure.
That just got ramping up one after the other.
After a brief moment of panic, I said, well, okay, and went to work trying to look at tapes and read things and ask questions again. So my first broadcast, it was on Randall's Island, which is between, the Bronx and Manhattan, I guess, in the East River in New York. And we're on the air. This is when Carl Lewis and Leroy Burrell had a great rivalry in the 100 meters, going back and forth, trading the championships and the world records. So this is the U.S. championships to choose the team that will compete in the world championships in Tokyo in another month. So we're on the air, and I say hello, and I introduce, I'm not going to say his name, my partner. He had been on the U.S. gold medal winning relay team at the Olympics in Los Angeles in 1984. So I said, well, you know, what are we, I don't remember exactly what I said, but what are we looking for today? And he said, well, we're, and he couldn't
oh,
speak.
No.
So I said, oh, well, I guess, you know, Carl Lewis and Leroy Burrell and their rivalry, that'd be great to watch. And it, and he couldn't speak.
Was he just
so nervous?
Nervous. Wow.
And the sad part about it was later, you know, you could hear him, you know, crying in the background.
Mm. Oh, God. But that's tough.
But, yeah, so, you know, they say, they all, of course, everybody teased me. They said that my face went white.
Well, that is the worst feeling, you know.
And in my mind, it said, all right, here's your first track broadcast. We got 2 hours to go, and your partner can't speak.
You're flying solo.
Yeah. 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 Wow. So, anyway, the pressure's on.
Yeah. So we made it. I made it through, and that was the beginning of my track and field career.
Mm-hmm.
Many great moments in doing that over those years.
We actually need a longer. We need like a four.
We're gonna have to have a part two. A part two
again, because everything leads to a story. When you get this old, that's all you do is tell stories.
And that's what we appreciate about you. Yes. And why we brought you on. We could literally listen.
The
to
The last
all
person
day.
You want on Hot Mic is somebody who doesn't have
exactly.
any stories.
We need you to be able to share those stories. I do want to do a few quick like lightning round questions. Ooh. Is that okay?
Yes, sure.
Let's do it.
And you can expand if you want.
Have you
to.
Had enough coffee?
Here's your chance to take a sip.
Yeah, I apologize in advance for the weak answers.
No. All right. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. These are Olympics related.
Okay.
But not. They don't have to be necessarily. Your favorite Olympic city.
You know, they all had something to offer.
Mm-hmm.
The worst was Atlanta. It was like going to the state fair instead of going to the Olympics.
It's also not nearly as exciting as going abroad right. for you.
But, you know, Beijing probably.
Okay.
And the Chinese people were so wonderful. And my wife and I went a couple of weeks early. We cruised on the Yangtze River and we met lots of Chinese people. And
wow.
It was tremendous. But, you know, it's hard to fault Sydney or Barcelona or London, any, you know.
So all of them except for Atlanta.
Rio. I mean, you could go on. They were all pretty interesting.
What does your passport look like?
Yeah, I had to get it. I didn't know there was such a thing. NBC actually arranged it. Extra pages.
Wow.
They had to put extra pages in.
That's
goals.
I was going to say, that's kind of, you can stunt on some people with that.
For real.
My passport has extra pages. The most underrated sport.
Well, figure skating, I guess, because a lot of people don't consider it a sport.
Yeah.
They think it's all, you know, and my goodness, not only the pressure which we've talked about, but also the skill it takes to do the different edges. I had no idea before I got into it.
Yeah.
You know, and the way, you know, the jumps are choreographed, and you know, you have to go into a triple axel, you go into it forward. The only one you go into it forward, you have extra half revolution, and you land on this edge or that edge. Mm-hmm. And Yeah, I had no idea it was so intricate. So,
have you ever attempted any of those moves?
Are you like, kidding? Have you seen how large I am? A large man.
Do you ice? Have you ever ice skated though?
I tried.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
It was not pretty.
Well, and this isn't my next question. What sport would you want to try that you think like maybe I could do that? Mm.
Every time we see something on television that's like, you know, figure skating or something, bobsledding or something, I say to my wife, I was good at that. Actually, I stole that from Bill Walton. Bill Walton, the late Bill Walton, was one of my NBA partners, and he would always say something like that. We'd be doing a game, and we'd have a promo for some wild sport, and Bill would say, I was very good at that.
I might steal that, too.
You should.
But I don't know. You know, I played football and basketball and baseball and all those things growing up, and was playing on the verge of playing football in college until I destroyed my ankle.
Okay.
Anyway, so but I don't know. I there's most of those things. There's no way I could do them, and I'm in awe of looking at.
That's what makes them so fun to watch.
And how easy they make it look.
Yeah.
And just some of the stuff they imagine. And back to Usain Bolt. Here's a guy, 6'5". Usually a sprinter that tall is just getting uncoiled out of the starting blocks before 100 meters is over. And he was just amazing what he could do. He's like from another planet. This guy is unbelievable. So he at the World Championships held in Tokyo earlier in 2025, summer 25, I got a text from Lewis Johnson, who was on our track and field crew then, and is a good friend of mine. And he and Usain Bolt sent a text to say hi, and they were in some little arcade or something shooting baskets. And I told him, well, you're lucky I'm not there because I'm from Kentucky, and I would make you look really bad.
In your blood. In your blood.
And Usain Bolt, I mean, what a fun-loving, interesting guy. Retired now. Soccer was his first love. And after he retired from sprinting, he even played for a team in Europe for a little while.
Yeah.
But he now owns a bar in Kingston, which is perfect for him, by the way.
He's just living his best life, I guess.
That
right?
is a
he's
fun tidbit.
Did you also cover Tyson Gay?
Yes, I did. In fact, in Osaka, Japan, at the World Championships, Tyson Gay beat Usain Bolt. And this would have been in 2007 before he burst, before Bolt burst onto the scene with setting a world record at the Olympics. But yes, and enjoyed talking to him and enjoyed meeting his family. We had a nice get together once out at Keeneland during the races.
Yeah.
And you know, and he was suspended for doping. And he said, you know, his manager, his trainer did it, gave him some stuff he shouldn't have taken, but he said, it's my responsibility, it's my fault. And mostly when the athletes are caught doing something like that, they want to blame something and somebody else and make all these excuses. I really was impressed with the way he took it like a man. He said, it's my fault, it's my responsibility.
Owned it.
Yeah, he owned it. So that was impressive to me.
Okay, this is going to probably be a tough question.
He's a Lafayette grad, too. As am I.
Oh, yeah.
They're two famous alumni there. I love that. You rep the school. Wow. This might be hard for you to pick.
Uh-oh.
Your favorite athlete ever.
And we're going to cut to the commercial.
Really, that really puts you on the spot here.
How do you choose? I mean, some of the ones we've mentioned, I guess, would be one. Michael Jordan would be one. Peyton Manning was always great to me. Tom Brady.
For us Hoosiers,
we appreciate that.
Yes, you do. Were y'all rooting for IU, by the way, in the football?
Since
you didn't go there, I know you went to Evie's DePaul and to Butler, right?
Right, yeah, but Evie's we both have Purdue ties.
Right.
But I think everyone was just excited.
Anyone from Indiana,
just because, looks good for the whole state, right?
Yeah.
Wish it could
you
be
gotta
Purdue.
You got to think big picture.
Yeah.
Totally.
Absolutely.
I spent lots of days in South Bend doing Notre Dame football.
There you go.
You are familiar, My mom's from Elkhart, which is not too far from South Bend. So.
Amish land.
Spend one day and drive over to West Lafayette when they played, before they played Purdue, to talk to the coaches and players.
He's done everything.
He gets it. I have a random question.
Uh-oh.
Your voice, everybody knows your voice, and it's so perfect for broadcast. I think you could have another career in reading audiobooks. That's a different conversation for a different time. But do you do anything to prep before, or did you do anything before you were calling a race or a game? Like, are we doing vocal exercises? Are we gargling? What's going on?
You'd be surprised how many people have asked me that. But
really?
No, not really.
It's just God-given.
When I was working here at the station and then began doing working at Keeneland, Keeneland also said, well, why don't you voice our commercials?
Yeah.
So I went to do a voiceover on a commercial at a recording studio and did it. And at the end of it, Ed Commons was his name that was doing the recording, the head of the deal that was doing the recording, said to me, you have an interesting voice. And it wasn't a compliment. So when people say I have a nice voice, it always comes as a surprise to me. And I haven't done anything for it. Maybe all those years of announcing the horse sales, when I would be up there for 8 hours reading these pedigrees and stuff, sort of, I don't know, trained it or gave it depth or did something. I don't know what, but I always remember him saying, you have an interesting voice.
Well, I think you have a great voice.
Look at you now. I know. It's like a soothing. It's the perfect broadcast.
The Tom Hammond voice. You just know
it. Totally.
You just know it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, people can look up your bio. You literally have a Wikipedia page, which I think gives you immediate street credibility. But
as long as it's all right on there. I don't know about
Wikipedia. This incredible career, so much to be proud of. But is there something outside of your career that people probably don't know that you're really proud of?
It sort of is with my career, but when people ask me what I was, there are two things that really I feel proud of, and I guess they do relate to my career, so I'm hedging on that answer. but when someone stops me in the airport, a stranger or someone else, and they say, I'm from Kentucky, and I just want you to know you make us proud.
Aww.
And, that's the best.
That's like the biggest compliment you could get.
Better than that. And I think it was after the Beijing Olympics that Lee Todd was the president of UK, and he took me out to center court at Rupp Arena during a basketball game. And, I was expecting polite, and just a prolonged standing ovation. And President Todd said, they love you. it took me by surprise. And Aww. It was just so gratifying because as a lifelong Kentuckian, Lexingtonian, for people to say something like that and to show you that appreciation, that's the best. And the other thing I'm kind of proud of is being able to do all those different sports, which is, not the normal course of events. And the fact that I always treated the people that worked behind the scenes with respect, and so many of them said that to me and how they appreciated me. I mean, they're back there trying to make me look good. Yeah. So why shouldn't I know their name, first of all, and be kind to them and appreciate what they're doing to help me look good? And so I always I just had such a great relationship with all the people working behind the scenes. And, at the Olympics, it's countless. I don't know how many people there are. And even at the Kentucky Derby, there were 250 people there from NBC working. And I tried to be as kind to all of them and appreciate what they do to make you succeed.
I have noticed you are good at names. You remember telling stories. You recall every single person's name, which is a skill, and it's a impressive,
it is.
Important
I have been
one.
I'm lucky to have a pretty good memory over. Yeah.
But there are so many people behind the scenes that the viewers never get to see.
That's
but
true.
It takes a whole village to bring a broadcast to life.
I mean, you can't imagine if you don't. People think you. You show up. You show up an hour before the game and sit down and just do the game. And, they don't understand all the preparation that goes into it and the days leading up to it. And they don't understand all the people behind the scenes doing all those different jobs that it takes to make a broadcast.
Shout out Hannah, our director, working hard behind the scenes
Hannah's
here.
Hannah's right over there right now.
Hannah finally. She has her own camera.
Right.
Wait,
well
she upgraded.
Done. Well done, Hannah.
See, she can do so many things at once. That's
I
what
I know.
They just
like
make it happen.
The piano
that is incredible.
All the different keys and things.
Do you have a piece of advice? Broadcasting has changed so much since you got into it, right? But do you have a piece of advice maybe for a young person who listens and thinks, I want a career even half as cool as his?
Yeah, first of all, you have to understand that to succeed, you're going to have to work at it. Mm-hmm. It's not just all, you know, oh, I want to be famous. I don't want to be famous.
Yeah.
No, you have to work at it. And I touched on it before. You have to be passionate about it. Mm-hmm. It has to be your passion, because you're going to get beat down many times mm-hmm. before you succeed, before you get what you want. So you have to be able to hang in there, stick in there, and understand that this is my passion. I'm going to do it. I'm going to give it my best shot. I say the same thing to athletes sometimes, too. Mm-hmm. Don't leave anything out there. Don't be, now 50 years old saying, oh, if only I had. Mm-hmm. And don't ever do that. Just leave it out there. And then if it doesn't work out, fine. You gave it your best shot. Mm-hmm. There are no regrets when you do that. But same thing for broadcasters. Again, if you find something you want, go after it. Mm-hmm. If there's an opportunity, go after it. Go after it. Maybe you won't succeed, but you've got to try. So you have no regrets in that regard. And again, if you have to take something lesser than what you're aiming for in order to get a start, that foot in the door, if there's anybody that can attest to that, it's me, because mm-hmm. I did that several times and was so lucky that it all worked out for me. But that's it. So be relentless in your pursuit of what you want and have passion about it. And if you don't have passion for it, you need to think about something else.
There you go. That can apply to all careers, right? I think that applies to a lot of different.
I think relentless. That will mm-hmm. have to go in, you know, the heading for this mm-hmm. podcast episode. This has been such a delight, Tom. Last question. What are you doing this year? What are you looking forward to?
Well, I'm enjoying the Olympics, watching, always watching any sporting event now. What would I have said, or how would I have done it? And sometimes I like my version better, sometimes I don't. I'm looking forward to travel always. That my mm-hmm. wife and I take lots of trips, and our family. I don't get to see my grandchildren often enough, so I enjoy being with them. And my oldest grandchild, Sarah, granddaughter, was an All-American soccer player.
Oh, wow.
At Wesleyan University in Connecticut.
Cool.
And
incredible.
So it was, and they went to the Final Four, so it was fun following that. So following mm-hmm. all the grandchildren's exploits is pleasurable to me. I'm a gardener. I have a vegetable garden. I have a rose garden and a flower garden, mm-hmm. which my wife and I take care of. We need some help these days. We're not as spry as we used to
Megan
be.
Megan and I will come over. We can help you. Yeah,
come on. And I supply the refreshments. How about that?
Perfect. Hey,
you can pay us in refreshments and stories.
Exactly. Oh,
I'll kill you with the story.
We're easy to please here on Hot Mic. Yeah. It sounds like you've earned the relaxation, mm-hmm. the downtime.
Yeah, and yes. And I miss the big events, I have mm-hmm. to say. I miss going to the Olympics. I miss the Kentucky Derby and the Triple Crown races. Mm-hmm. I miss, big football game at Notre Dame. There's nothing much better than that. Mm-hmm. And all the different NBA playoff games, NFL playoff games, all those things. But what I don't miss is going to the airport every week. Mm-hmm. Over 6 million miles just on Delta.
Oh, my gosh.
Do you have elite status on Delta? What is your... He's like triple platinum.
Seriously. Wait, I had one last question I forgot to ask. For our listeners and viewers, if there is one sporting event that they should try to get to before they die, what would you say?
That's a good question.
Well, of course, the Olympics.
Okay.
My wife has been to 13 Olympics, and one of us had to have fun because we had... The other one was working pretty hard.
Right.
But the Olympics, of course, if you can find a way to do that. And the Super Bowl is pretty special. Mm-hmm. I guess the only really regret I have in my career is that I never got to broadcast a Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. And I would have, mm-hmm. but we didn't have the rights to it at that time when I was, when I was at the top of the heap there. We didn't have the rights to it, so... Mm-hmm.
That pesky legal stuff, all the
bad timing in that regard. But that's pretty special. And I think the Kentucky Derby is on a lot of people's wish list. Mm-hmm. And it is a special event. You guys know because you're older.
I try not to, but we almost take it for granted, just that mm-hmm. opportunity. You know, you're there every year, but for so many people, it is a once in a lifetime.
For sure.
Opportunity.
And it's not just the race, as you know. Mm-hmm. And, I have to count them up. I've been to about 50 of them.
That might be a record.
No, I'm sure there's some of them.
There probably are.
But it was one of the great thrills of my mm-hmm. life. One of my great ambitions was to someday broadcast the Kentucky Derby, mm-hmm. and I was able to do that. And thank goodness for American Pharoah, because I thought I might not ever broadcast a Triple Crown again.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
I'd been standing next to my friend Chick Anderson when Affirmed beat Aledar in 1978. I was in the Belmont Stakes. I was standing right next to him, and as he called the race on CBS and at the track. And so I witnessed that one Triple Crown, and I was, during these years I started to broadcast the Triple Crown races, I thought Smarty Jones would do it. He didn't do it. You know, all these near misses. And I was, you know, afraid I would never broadcast a Triple Crown until American Pharoah came along. And that was, that scene at the Belmont Stakes as he won the Triple Crown was, of all the things that that I've been to, and I don't know, that was one of the great moments. You know, there's so many, and some of the greatest moments don't even involve Americans. Kathy Freeman, the Aboriginal Australian, I think is maybe, if people ask me what was my all-time favorite. And you're out of time, I'm sure.
No.
Keep it rolling.
We don't really have a time limit.
Okay. So, because it requires a little background. So,
Tom, you need your own podcast.
I think so. We can host you here. Yeah.
So, Kathy Freeman was an Aboriginal Australian runner. She ran the 400 meters. Mm-hmm. And the 400 meters wasn't run for women in the Olympics until 1960, and it was won by an Australian woman. So now we fast forward to 1996, the Atlanta Olympics, and Kathy Freeman finishes second in the 400 meters. Now knowing that in 4 years' time, the Olympics are going to be in Sydney. So the pressure begins to mount. Here's an Australian runner. She was second the last time. Now she's going to win it here in Australia for all our Australian fans. And an Aboriginal person has never won an Olympic gold medal. So 1996 to 2000, and 2000 now we're in Sydney, and we're lining up for the women's 400 meters. And as they got into the starting blocks, I said that Kathy Freeman has waited 4 years for this moment. Australians have waited 40 years, and her Aboriginal people have waited forever.
Wow.
And as they came to the top of the home straightaway, there's no way that this is going to have a happy ending. There's no way she's going to win the race. Mm-hmm. And during those last strides down that home straightaway, her form is just, she's flailing around. Her form is just terrible. Somehow, she finds a way to will herself to victory. Somehow, she crosses that finish line first. And a few steps past the finish line, she just collapses to the track. And knowing that not only the exertion of winning that race when it seemed impossible, but the weight of the world lifted from her shoulders. Because not only had she been favored to win the race and expected to win the race by her Australian countrymen, but she had gotten the singular honor of lighting the Olympic flame at the opening ceremonies.
Wow.
So here she is, and now the weight of the world lifted from her shoulders, with 120,000 Australians in the Olympic Stadium roaring their approval. And I think maybe that's my most favorite event, if I had to pick just one.
That was amazing.
I know. I feel the way that you tell stories, I feel like I am sitting there, you know, watching it on my TV, listening to you in real time. I think Hannah might be a little busy. We're going to have to maybe sprinkle in some of these stretch calls and some of these big moments.
We've
into
got
the podcast.
Some videos to go pull up on YouTube.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Well, Tom, thank you so much for stopping by. And I would encourage anyone who wants to hear more about your career and your amazing life, they can read your book. Yeah. Where can they find it?
Joseph Beth or Amazon or any of those.
Awesome.
Wherever you buy your books, I guess.
Okay.
Okay. So, and it's been circulating my dad's friend group right now. I gave it to him expecting him to give it back to me, and suddenly it's in Cass County, Indiana.
It's going on a trip.
It really is. Yeah.
But. Well, you're nice to say that, and I'm happy your dad and your dad.
Yes, I also gave him a copy, too.
And again, I apologize for all the stories and all this.
Do not apologize. No.
Tom.
Crazy stuff.
The perfect get. You are welcome at Hot Mic anytime.
We'll save this spot for you.
Sad to say there are even more stories. So,
Okay. Well, we will see you out at your vegetable garden in the spring.
And come to Keeneland to see me.
We do. Okay. Yep. You don't have to ask us twice.
I know. We didn't make it there in the fall, but we it's priority
so
in the spring.
You do have to ask us twice, but we will get there.
It's the greatest. It's the greatest, and it's been so important to my career. Mm-hmm. But I'm honored to have a seat in the press box with my name on it. So,
oh,
that's pretty cool.
Okay.
That's really neat.
Very cool.
We got to go see that in
yes,
person.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Tom Hammond, thank you so much for coming to Hot Mic, and we're going to see you again on the podcast.
That'll be fine anytime. And thank you for having me. It was fun, and I hope I didn't just kill you with the stories.
No, this was fantastic. No. Evie, you have to do like the stretch call, like the bring us home.
Well, maybe you can do that. Can you do a stretch call to bring Hot Mic home? Bring Hot Mic to the finish line. What would you say? If there was a horse named Hot Mic and it's winning.
Wait, that's a great idea.
Can you do it on the spot?
All right. And here, final stages now. Here's Hot Mic. Hot Mic surging to the front. Here's the finish. Hot Mic by a head.
Woo! That was so good. Oh my gosh.
I wish we could have that every, we might have to use that over again.
All right. We need a new promo. That was fantastic. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
And thank you to our listeners. We will see you next time on a new episode of Hot Mic.